You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman. Today, we're bringing you our annual Hosts of Talking Machines conversation, where we get a chance to sit down with Ryan and Neil and talk with them about what they've been excited about lately. And we recorded this episode at NIPS 2017, early in the conference, shortly after Ali Rahimi delivered his lecture in receiving the Test of Time Award for the paper Random Features for Large-Scale Kernel Machines that he wrote with Ben Recht. And we'll have a video of that lecture up at our website at thetalkingmachines.com. And if you haven't seen it or you didn't get to see the lecture in person, it might be worth it to pause the episode right here, watch it, and come back to the conversation. So let's pick up there with Ryan and Neil and talking about the Test of Time lecture at NIPS 2017.
I think these kinds of stories about how papers come into existence, how ideas come into existence, how people collaborate and how they do their work, I think these are always really valuable, right? Because they help particularly younger people understand that the research process is not a magical thing, and it helps humanize the people who do this work. I think it's really I thought that was great, and I also thought that I think that some of the discussion on social media about his talk kind of attacked a straw man version of that talk.
I was thinking about that, and the term alchemy is, I love the idea of alchemy. I think for some people it's different. For some people you say alchemy and it's really insulting.
Well, it sounds like pseudoscience.
And right? Other people, yeah. It's like, oh, it was kind of a misguided thing, but they did an incredible, before they worked out that couldn't work, they did an incredible, like Newton was an alchemist. They discovered all these things through alchemy.
Alchemy was proto-science.
Yeah, proto-science. That's a great way of putting it. It's not pseudoscience, proto-science.
And we should say that in the talk, in that where Ben Recht was awarded the Test of Time Award for his paper that we've talked about, Ali Rahimi, right, was delivering this talk, said machine learning is now alchemy, right? And that's the quote that we're talking about.
I was thinking about it. We've hinted at this in previous talks.
Listeners won't have the talk. Everyone should go listen
to the talk.
It's on YouTube.
Online. Yes.
And I was thinking we've hinted at some of these issues around talking machines. Mm. I mean, one of my questions for me is, well, sure, but what do we actually do about it? It's not like that we can sort of suddenly police it and have like the machine learning police. If we did, then we would put Ryan in charge, superintendent of the machine learning police. Actually, you would be like a Texas Ranger.
The machine learning sheriff.
Alone, sort of with the...
I'm assuming you already have the hat.
I do, actually.
So policing it, apart from
great,
by Ryan.
I need a great vest, though.
I'm liking the image of machine learning as the Wild West. I actually prefer that
Spurs.
Image. In many respects, I prefer the image of machine learning as a sort of pioneering in an area where you've got to make up a lot of stuff on the fly. You're just trying to, but then you to be successful, to not be left with a ghost town or something else, there has to be a bit more substantial stuff. And I sort of see that the substantial stuff is, well, what do you do to sort of deal with this? You're not going to, like all these people trying these things, you're not going to be able to stop them. You're not going to be able to sort of license it. So I think the question is how do we prevent that having a negative effect?
Yeah. I think it might be helpful to actually kind of also just talk through kind of what, maybe to try to paraphrase a little bit of what Ali Rahimi sort of talked about in this talk and kind of like what this was about. And I think he was really, in my view, he was calling for the scientific method to be applied to machine learning and deep learning in particular, which is something that I feel like I sort of talk about a lot. I will say also that like, every now and then you see somebody give a talk and you think, man, I wish I had given that talk. And this is definitely one of those. I just thought, wow, what an amazing sort of message. But I think it boils down when he used the word rigor, I think what he really meant was let's make sure that we're doing science. And rigor here doesn't mean, I think some people took his use of the word rigor to mean theoretical results. But really, I think what he meant was rigorous investigation, right? Well, let's study things. Let's apply reductionist ideas. Let's go to the simplest situation that we can understand and then grow from there rather than jumping.
That's actually what the Recht paper was the press conference was about, is actually empirical analysis of SGD versus ADAM. That's not a theoretical thing. You just take a simpler model, you do some empirical analysis, and that is the process of science. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And to that end, he gave an example that I thought was quite inspirational and very simple. And and revealed already, you know, kind of instantaneously revealed some of the challenges in this of doing this kind of science. So his point, I think, was kind of like, here's like the simplest possible deep network in a sense. Here's the simplest possible MLP. Doesn't have a ReLU or a sigmoid or whatever your favorite nonlinearity is. Doesn't have multiple layers. Doesn't do anything fancy at all. Doesn't even have, you know, it doesn't even have like a fancy loss. It just has, you know, this like least squares loss and SGD fails.
Hmm. So I think that the point where Jan was making on Facebook about it, which I think is also an interesting one, is how does one translate that to something in practice? You know, and what Jan likes to say is, oh, well, that told everyone that, you know, you couldn't have perpetual motion machines and made sure it didn't do that work. But in some sense, it defined the limits of what was possible, which I think is quite a fair point. You know, that if a theory to be useful, it has to guide your practice in some way.
Yeah, I guess I'm not totally convinced that we learn that much about limits from purely empirical exploration, right? Like we get hints about them, but it happens all the time.
No, meaning like that normally theory is the way we understand those limits and where not to try. So I think that was Jan's point, which I sort of find I think that the problem for me is you can perhaps have to do a lot of theory before you come up with something that sort of actually says people don't try X. You know, that's kind of the ideal outcome from a lot of this work. You know, don't do Y with Z combined because we just know it's never going to work for theoretical reasons. But that's actually quite a difficult thing to get to. You often have to do a lot of theory before you get such a simple sort of summary rule.
Yeah, I don't think the use of rigor here is entirely about theory. I totally agree that theory is valuable and it's a component of that, but it also means just reductionist empirical investigation. Like I feel like our empirical evaluations in machine learning are like right now consist not always, but generally often consist of just trying to put numbers on a scoreboard. Mm. And both the authors and the reviewers often try to always view everything through this sort of poorly defined and not very interesting idea of state of the art on a small number of visual object recognition data sets. And that's not good empiricism.
There are people who are implementing these things that don't worry about this stuff. And in some sense, you're kind of saying that as well, that at one level this is going on, but at another level, there's a lot of people doing stuff that aren't worrying about it.
Well, and I think fitting into the other thing, the question is what kind of work gets press releases? Careful investigations of fairness and ways that like linear regression doesn't necessarily always have the weights that we'd like our society to.
You can write your own press release for that.
Yeah, right? You can definitely write a press release for that.
We did write a press release.
We did write a press release for careful investigations of fairness. We should talk about other stuff at the conference.
We should totally talk about other stuff.
The only thing that happened. As I said, I thought Kate Crawford's talk.
I actually didn't.
You didn't make it. Well, she was such a professional.
I'm going to go back and watch the video.
Yeah, but there was a sort of. She gave great examples of the different types of bias, how it can manifest. I think one thing that's exciting is when you see the social scientists who've really gained a deeper understanding of the way machine learning's worked. I mean, she's a Microsoft research, mm-hmm. right? And so she's like, there's people like Hannah Wallach around her and Jen Waltman Vaughan. And, you know, I find that very, so we've talked about some of the challenges, but I find that very exciting. There's going to be the symposium on interpretability later on. There's a lot going on which are outreach to these different fields. And I think that there's an increasing understanding from social scientists, lawyers, philosophers about some subset of that community.
Absolutely. I have to say, like, many times I talk to grad students who are trying to get into the field, and they often talk about how this is the thing that they want to work on. Like quite a lot.
The sort of fairness interpretability side.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think it's a great sign.
I think it's a great sign because it also it brings up so many issues about it makes you more thoughtful about how you're deploying in practice as well, which I think is critical. You know, there's this challenge that people are doing things that affect people's lives. And we don't fully understand all that we understand kind of what we're deploying, but we don't necessarily understand the longer term societal effects. But we should be thinking carefully. We hope that the practitioners are thinking carefully about what they're doing. I think we get the sense that that is going on as well, certainly from this year's NIPS.
So at least from my perspective, the conversation around interpretability has really spiked in the last year. Usually, annually, there's kind of a thing that people are really excited about, but interpretability seems to be one of the fundamental questions that we really need to keep talking about it. How do you think we keep this conversation going? Or is it going to wane with like next year's really cool model?
I think it's partially being driven probably by regulation as well. So people mention the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation. I'm sure I've already said this. I think it should just be called good data practice rules. And then people would view it, you know, like, because some of the stuff that's in there, you kind of think, if you view it another way, if you say, oh, this isn't a lawyer telling me to do this stuff. If you just think, oh, you know, that would be useful if I could explain why my algorithm has made this decision under these circumstances. That seems like something you would want your system to do. It's almost like, but if a lawyer tells me to do it, then I mustn't have to do it. And I know that there's conditions, it is difficult, there's conditions under which it's challenging, there's some questions of interpretability, but I think that that's one reason that it will continue to drive. And I don't think it's just the sort of phenomenological thing of the year. I think this is a field where people have been working on this for a number of years, mm-hmm. that it's just sort of rising to the surface, that there's a good solid underpinnings there. And a lot of people have been talking about it. I don't know what you, Brian, think.
Yeah, I guess it's something that I think is a little bit, still a little hard to formalize. Right. And there's always this tension between, you know, I think there's always a tension in practice between models that are sort of somehow easier to interpret versus models that actually are more performant. Like that's something that always comes up, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, in medicine or something, right? Would you rather have a more accurate cancer diagnosis or one that is easier to understand? And, you know, I think there's like, it's a little hard to reason about that, I think. So I think, you know, there's still a lot of work to do just trying to understand what it is exactly that we ask of these tools.
Well, one approach is to try and do both. So, I mean, it's funny, this case, you were also mentoring at WIML. I was on one of the mentoring tables at WIML, and this question came up. I was on the Bayesian statistics, Bayesian methods, which is a weird one because now you get people who are interested in, say, Bayesian neural networks and people who are actively interested in medical applications. And it almost feels like, well, the reason we're doing probability in these two cases is kind of different. But I think, you know, and actually the two cases you sort of might be referring to, one is, oh, I've got some predictive model I've integrated out all the parameters, and they're not necessarily interpretable and it's making a good prediction. Alongside, I might have some logistic regression form that I'm trying to interpret what those parameters are. But it feels to me a little bit, it's a false dichotomy. I mean, we can use, and I like Carlos Gestrin's work in this way, where you're sort of trying to put interpretable models on top of the more predictive one to try and extract that. And maybe we can get the best of both worlds that way. That seems like a good way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the way I think of what you just said is that there are situations where you create a model with the intention of that model being interpretable. Classic examples of this would be people interpreting the weights from a regression in a genome-wide association study, right, to try to identify effects. And then there's this other view, which is I'm going to train the best model I can and build a suite of tools to interrogate that model post hoc, to ask it somehow what it knows about the world, right? And I think these are two sort of complementary sort of approaches to this.
And you know, one way I think about it sometimes is like statistics itself was invented to try and understand very complex systems, society where we didn't have good models. And they build simpler models to sort of sit on top of the data. And, you know, they know that that's not, that everything's not working as a linear regression. They're carefully constructing models that give some interpretability. But I am a little bit worried about the idea that we should err towards more interpretable models for the whole prediction, because I feel then we're in danger of using simplistic models, which will probably, they will discriminate because they'll be like classification models or something. But because if we think of the bias variance dilemma, they're going to be on the bias side and they will be consistently making errors about certain subsections of the population because they're simpler than they could be in order to get the interpretability. So that also seems like a potential trap to fall into, to not do the best prediction you can and try to do the post facto interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question, which is that does interpretability, I mean, I think we feel like interpretability is somehow exactly living along this bias variance trade-off with models, but that's not something that I've seen formalized. I think it's something we kind of believe, right?
We intuit, yeah.
Support for this episode of Talking Machines comes from Google. When you're building an application, you need it to be fast, secure, and always evolving. With Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform, developers can deploy fully managed containerized apps quickly and easily. Google has been running production workloads in containers for over 15 years. They build the best of what they learn into Kubernetes, the industry-leading open-source container orchestrator. Kubernetes Engine combines automatic scaling, updates, and reliable self-healing infrastructure with open-source flexibility to cut down deployment cycles and speed up time to market. To learn more about Kubernetes Engine, visit g.co/getgke. That's g.co/getgke.
Our guest this week on Talking Machines is Shira. He's a lecturer in the Department of Electrical and Electronic Engineering at Dedan Kimathi University in Nyeri, Kenya, and we got a chance to talk with him at Data Science Africa. And we asked him the first question we ask all of our guests on Talking Machines. How did you get where you are?
I was born in Kenya, in Nairobi, so that's, you know, that's where I spent the first maybe 23 years of my life in Nairobi, in Kenya. I went to school, yeah, primary, you know, secondary, ended up at University of Nairobi, which at one point was actually a constituent college of the University of London. The beginning. So
wasn't your dad a professor at University of Nairobi?
Yeah, eventually he was a professor of biochemistry. My dad, actually, that's probably the real beginning. You know, my dad was instrumental. I grew up with all these books in the house, and anyway, that's a story for another day. I went to the University of Nairobi, studied engineering for 5 years between 2002 to 2007. I think halfway through doing electrical engineering, I always felt at some point I wish I had done something like physics, which was very more fundamental. And I felt also a bit shortchanged by the way things, maybe I shouldn't say this, but you know, I yearned for, you know, let me go where things appear to be really happening, which is, in my view, I thought at that point when I was really young, I thought, okay, things are really happening in technology in America. Let me try get study in America. So I finished my bachelor's and I applied to a couple of programs for PhD directly. I didn't, you know, I don't even know why I did that. So people were asking me, oh, you're not going to do a master's, or you're not, you know, there's this trajectory that's supposed to be followed. So I got into some PhD program at Drexel in Philadelphia. I was doing still electrical engineering, signal processing.
But that's hard, isn't it? I mean, it's not easy to go from African undergraduate university direct into a PhD, particularly without a master's.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was hard. So I luckily, you know, it was really like a scholarship. You know, you have this research assistantship, teaching assistantship. I was under John Walsh. I think he's still there, still doing a lot of information theory. So I was thrown in some really deep end with all this nice math, which I was, you know, I was happy to do. It was a good time. I mean, really interesting academically. It was, you know, PhDs are always tough. So I think when I left, that's in Philly. When I left Philly, I don't think I've been back. There's always that trauma, I think, of the location you do your PhD. At least for me, it felt that way. So luckily, the strange thing, man, when I was at the end, I still sort of still wanted to be an academic, so I was looking for postdocs. And I was going through, I mean, and then I don't know how I saw the at Neil's lab in Sheffield with Magnus. They wanted They wanted a postdoc. And again, I think I always have this feeling of always being, maybe dissatisfied is a strong word, but always yearning for more. So with my bachelor's, I was like, no, I need to go to America. Then the trajectory started heading homewards, you know. Now I started saying, let me look, what can I actually do back at home? And I saw that the big labs were really into biological research, and I really, really wanted to be in it. And then I was like, okay, my background is computational. Computational biology is interesting. And then I landed in UPenn's library. There was the book you guys did.
Oh, yeah, Learning and Influencing Computational Systems.
Yeah, I landed on that. I read it before we interviewed. I was, yeah, this area looks interesting. And actually, I interviewed, and a few minutes, an hour or two later, I got the call. I was like, this is madness. These guys want me to come. I didn't think I would get the job, to be honest, as a postdoc at the University
of Sheffield. The thing you haven't mentioned is you were moved into speech.
Yeah.
You were doing a PhD in speech.
Yeah, I was doing speech. And I sort of felt like I was a bit insignificant in speech. So what could I be significant at? Maybe biology, maybe computational biology. So I ended up there. So I did that for two years. And then even as I was in Sheffield, the first year was great. It was all great, Neil. But I, at some point, I really started feeling I need to be home. I'm working here. It's all well and good, but it feels like I'm working on work that's
this
not.
This wasn't just the weather.
No, the weather in Sheffield was great, you know. But it was actually much. It's the kind of town I like, you know. Even where I work now in Nyeri is similar.
Oh yeah, I mean
it's nice and calm.
We'll come back. Nyeri is beautiful. Real eye-opener for me when we did the first Data Science Africa there. So Shearer is the person, when he left, I said, we're going to do a workshop when you're settled. And so in some sense, that those words are the foundation of Data Science Africa. And of course, John Quinn is, you know, is the magician that sort of has all pulled all the strings to make it a successful workshop. and of course, your work. But that location, the eye-opener for me was that's where the Mau Mau Rebellion was, and your university is named after one of the leaders.
Didan Kimathi was a field marshal in the Mau Mau Rebellion.
And those are horrible times. I mean, the British have a terrible history in that region. I mean, your mum was living in a concentration camp when...
You could call it that. There were these internment villages.
I think. This is post-Second World War, so it's kind of pretty horrific what was going on.
It is. And when I look at her trajectory, it's quite interesting that you can talk to somebody who was in one of these... You know, people were dispossessed of all they had, all their land, and put into this internment camps. And then, I don't know whether they were to stay there forever, but, you know, when you're free now... I felt, let me tell you the truth. When I was going back home, I really felt like I can't be away from home and that's also one of the reasons I went to Dedan Kimathi University, because I was like, these people made such a huge sacrifice so that I could be, you know, an upright standing man, you know, so that when I'm standing and I'm walking, I'm like, you know, I'm a man. Which, I mean, a lot of people may not be able to identify with that statement, but it's people of color in America will identify with that, and people in oppressed minorities will identify with that statement. I noticed that. I think when I was in America, I noticed that I was able to, I have this rich thing which is propping me back, and I needed to give back.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing, the university set in the grounds of an old coffee plantation. So it was a colonist's location, but now it's this university. It's a beautiful setting. I mean, you can see why they were fighting over that land.
It's beautiful.
Because it's the altitude, the temperatures, just very similar to Russia. Mm. I mean, the temperature's very nice most of the year round. The university has a conservancy on site. Actually, you heard a little bit about your work in the conservancy, Shira.
My PhD work was in speech, just signal processing, approximate Bayesian inference in speaker recognition, actually. So just speech processing. But I moved into comp bio, where I was learning. I went really, I think, more into the machine learning and, you know, inference of transcription, which again was interesting, but I felt I needed to come closer to the people, closer to the ground, in various areas. I tried to, as I said, bring it to the ground. I was like, yeah, environmental conservation is interesting. Agriculture is, of course, key. So I can't say I found my footing yet. I'm still, you know, groping in the dark there for a research angle that I can actually follow. But I've been doing work in ecosystem monitoring at our conservancy. So we have this nice conservancy Neil has visited. You could be working on your computer in your office 1 second, the next minute, I mean, not minute really, but in within like 30 minutes, you're walking in the conservancy counting birds, which is what I do.
Well, in Data Science Africa, we had Mushiri take us around. Yeah. Before the morning session, we had a dawn walk in the conservancy.
Right, at 6 a.m.
At 6 a.m.
Seeing zebras, colobus monkeys. Water bucks.
And for some reason, a llama.
Yeah, there's a llama.
The
llama is there. I don't know why it's there, but it's not wild. It's
no.
Domestic. Yeah, llama is a domestic animal.
But You've been doing work, field work in the conservancy with the birds, right?
Yeah, and the idea is, you know, to do automatic acoustic recognition of the bird species and then use that to infer, the state of ecosystem. So I have some work starting off there, but going into the Mount Kenya National Park, monitoring acoustic bird populations acoustically. I can't pinpoint exactly where it started, but I was sort of looking. It's like I was walking around with this toolbox, and signal processing was in that toolbox. Machine learning was in that toolbox.
You mean
toolbox.
Like a mental toolbox?
Yeah, a mental toolbox.
The tools that you felt you could
deploy. Yeah, all these tools that I have. And I think actually I can now pinpoint where it started. It started at the first Data Science Africa school, because at that school, I mean, Mushiri is a conservancy coordinator, David Mushiri. And
it's from the Kenya, it used to be in the Kenyan Wildlife Service that runs the parks, right? It used to be Mount Kenya.
I think he was a naturalist at one of the hotels there.
Yeah.
And then at DSA 2015, we really now interacted on a closer level, and I got to know him. And then I think from going into the conservancy, I hadn't even been into that conservancy in the way we went around, you know, really. I think that's where the seed was planted, that, wait a minute, I can't say exactly, but I think that's where it started.
You started also, you were looking, also interested in looking at herbal medicine, I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Mushiri's a bit of an expert on the herbal medicine plants, the local remedies.
Yeah, that was an idea that was born in because of my computational biology stuff background. And then I tried to, I was still, you know, coming with my old ideas, fitting them into, you know, as opposed to now just being on the ground and then letting new ideas just come.
But the challenge here as well is building the research culture, because you landed in Dedankamathi, and so you'd been there by 2 years by then, and within 6 months of landing, you were head of department.
And, you know, in African universities, sometimes you get saddled with all this administrative stuff. So you wouldn't believe that I'm head of department. I mean, you know, I come here and I'm like, what sort of department gets headed by me? You know,
a very good one.
So that's where I was, and then I think I liked the intersection, because I also work with an ornithologist called Peter Njoroge from the National Museums of Kenya. So what we do is we collect audio. I got a grant from the Kenya Education Network that's headed by Meoli Kashoda, and he gave us a grant to do to look into how the Raspberry Pi could be used for education, for electrical engineering education. And then I had this device, and I could plug a microphone in it and leave it in the bush, and got audio, be able, and then take that audio, give it to Peter Njoroge at NMK, and he would tell me, okay, it has X number of species in it. And then use that data, I could, get some features, classify, you know, be able to tell it's X species, Y species. And then we settled on one species that was quite interesting, the Hartlaps turaku, that we wanted to, you know, monitor, and because it's easy enough to identify acoustically, and also its range is being affected. You know, anecdotal evidence is saying that it's being pushed higher and higher up in altitude. So we're still deploying sensors. So in other words, that project is we aim to, you know, really take it quite far, but right now it's baby steps. It's combining low cost electronics, a bit of citizen science, and me trying to impose myself in another discipline now. I tried computational biology, and now I'm trying to invade on ethology, ecology.
But it's not just because of that bird, is it? It's this idea of an indicator species, which I think you expressed very well. The last data science, yeah. Africa, there's a video of that. By tracking these birds, they're easier to track because they have song, and then you can actually try and understand how the ecology is being affected on a broader scale.
That's right, because birds are easy to assess. And once you assess the birds, you can then try and infer what's going on with the ecosystem. And then now, even among the birds, there are certain birds, like now the Hatlab's Turaku, whose range you can it's easy enough to monitor acoustically, and then you can make, you know, links to even climate change with range being contracted.
I mean, and I think it's really interesting the pressures on land in the area. Mm-hmm. As you know, you've kindly organized for me to go running with Rashid, who's one of the rangers from the Conservancy on Mount Kenya. And we were talking about that. And he was asking me, what are the national parks in UK? And I remember, I said, well, they kind of are, but they're preserving the bit that's outside the national park here. You know, in terms of, and that really struck me, that Mount Kenya is a national park. It's amazing land. There's people all around it who can't get the grazing land, who have their cattle or their goats. You know, there's many sort of nomadic grazers in Kenya. And the bit we preserve in our national park is something that came after nomadic grazers. It's like old style hill farming or something like that. But the pressures in Kenya are to preserve something in a pristine environment, the thing that we don't even have in the West anymore. And
it's quite interesting because also that's leading up to some other work I've been trying to get into, which is looking into human-wildlife conflict. So you can actually... I mean, there's a lot of pressure on these pristine ecosystems. So that's beginning the work with the birds. But also now, how do you promote coexistence? How can you use technology to ensure that people and humans, can actually coexist? That's an interesting problem, which I'm interested in. You know, you could figure all sorts of deep, interesting machine learning algorithms which could help you achieve that.
I remember the gamekeepers sort of saying, well, I, you know, shooting of poachers, that's not such a problem. Shooting wildlife, that's a big, big problem. And you realize the extent to which external pressures come in on Kenya to preserve this wildlife that are then affecting people locally.
Yeah.
And talking to various people about the extent to which poachers are ex-wardens in the parks. Uh-huh. And very, very complex.
Yeah, it's a bit more complex than I'm used to in you know, just dealing with, you know, algorithms and things. But it's I think it's one of the challenges I put on myself as an engineer as a scientist, is how can you now bring solutions to such big problems, even if it's using machine learning? How can machine learning now be, you know, impacting, you know, livelihoods at that level? So things in food security, you know, because it impacts food security and things like that. Climate change, you get all this data. Weather data, you can have all this sensor data, you can have, you know, farmers with their history of what they've planted, how they've succeeded or failed, what sort of practices they've used. How can you get that into some form they can consume? I mean, the data that they can consume and actually make intelligent decisions that actually now make the difference between hunger and you know, having food. Because, I mean, right now in Kenya, we are staring at the second failed maize season, you know. And why are we still insisting on planting maize, you know, when we could have a hardier crop? You know, when the last season, actually, we do some farming on the side. And so I actually look at the clouds and I always ask myself, Shira, you're supposed to be this machine learning guy. Why why are you, you know, just doing things without, you know, actually, and actually using predictive methods. But then the problem is that maybe we don't get them into a way that can be easily consumed. So that and then actually provide the alternatives, so that, you know, there's almost like with Ralph's talk today about, I mean, in reference to Amazon with improving customer experience. So it's sort of like improving farmer experience. Why would they be able to choose to plant X as opposed to Y? So, for example, a hardier crop like sorghum as opposed to maize.
That's one thing. I mean, so you mentioned that, and it brought home to me again when he talked about that thing that Amazon pushes about customer obsession as being that company. That's kind of what Data Science Africa's tried to do, I think. Identify the pain points of the people who you're trying to help. So in this case, yeah. You know, okay, there's, let's call everyone customers. I mean, yeah. I know we don't tend to do that so much, but you know, but these people's pain points, farmers, yeah. Understanding whether they should plant maize, getting the right advice.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the work Ernest does with machine learning. That sort of, in fact, that's been the great
who's,
thing.
Who's Alice?
Ernest Mbaza.
Ernest, oh yeah, sorry, I thought you said yeah. Alice. Yeah, Ernest, yeah.
And, you know, work that actually impacts people. So those are the deep questions I'm interested. You know, I personally believe in having the bigger ideal of actually impacting people. So it's upon you to make it obvious that you actually are impacting people.
Shira, it was so interesting to hear your conversation with him, Neil. I especially love to hear about the origins of Data Science Africa. It was so cool.
You know, he was my postdoc, you know, he's quite a lot younger than me.
Really?
But I kind of feel he's wiser than me. He looks wiser than me as well. And I often feel when I'm listening to him, I'm always learning something. But he's doing some cool stuff. And actually, we're going to be back in Nyeri in this June for Data Science Africa, where we'll be sort of, we're going to start doing teaching of teachers. So trying to train up people to do more.
Oh, fantastic.
More Data Science Africa's sort of expend. There's also going to be a one in Abuja. That's the plan in Nigeria. So trying to get it sustainable and scalable also supporting some of Shira's projects while we're out there. Really looking forward to it.
Excellent. And eventually there will be the Data Science Africa, the NIPS of the Data Science Africas.
Travel in Africa is very difficult. So to get access to people, we're very interested in making sure that there's regional meetings that people can travel to. And then you want a robust network of places where people can collaborate within short traveling distance. But to do that, we need sort of many different venues. But then I think that the nice idea would be eventually to sort of then have one main conference, the big coming together, which is focused on these challenges and sharing of information. I don't know when that will happen, but that would be just a wonderful thing to come to pass. But for the moment, it's just about trying to sort of scale up and get the teaching out there. And Shira's been a key part of that. And as I say, you know, it's sort of funny, you see, you know, it's always interesting watching the students and postdocs develop. I just see this massive discontinuity in the postdoc that left me and then the responsibility he has now.
Well, that's it for us on Talking Machines this week. I'm Catherine Borman. Tune in next episode.